Hey, this is Chris, and for this episode of TC Talks, I'm going to share an episode of another podcast I've been working on, and that's All Consumed. I co-produce All Consumed with fellow food, drink, and travel writer Neil Davey. This is our second episode, and the topic is meat. Here it is. Consumed, our second episode. This is Chris Osborne. I'm here with my compadre, Neil Davey. And
hello.
We are at M Restaurant near Bank Station in one of the private dining spaces.
The den,
I think. Yes. Neil got the better, he took the better straw, so he's actually going ahead and eating this Wagyu tartare. Well, I actually talk about it, so he's a smarter man than me.
But, just to prove, look, cutlery plates, there we go.
And we're having Wagyu tartare because our second episode is all about meat.
Meat, indeed.
Yes. And respecting meat. So not just going out and eating whatever you want, but actually eating something really quality, you know, less is more, and that sort of thing. Respecting the meat. So we've got a few segments in this episode, but before we get to those, we also have some news that we have a theme song.
Hooray!
And that is by some friends of mine back in the U.S. called E-Nub. That's the letter I, and then N-U-B. You can find them on Spotify, iTunes, everything. And the song is called The Year Was Strange. App title for anything I think Neil and I potentially do.
I would echo that.
And, yeah, so we're going to Neil. What are we going to talk about?
Sorry, I've got
a mouthful
of
meat.
Well, Chris, sort of smear some on a beautiful piece of toasted brioche. Here we go. Cutlery plate.
Yeah.
I think it's a meat. It's obviously something very close to our hearts, and we've both got a big love of all things barbecue. But I think there's an awareness recently, and even the likes of Richard Turner, butcher and the exact chef at Hawksmoor, saying we need to be less but better quality meat. And it's interesting, you don't have to look too far, I think, to find many, many examples of that. And here we are in M with the Wagyu with the tartare. I mean, it was something
so good.
Didn't know an awful lot about. But happily, Mike Reed, who is the chef at M, is on hand to talk us through it all. Here we are in the one of several private dining rooms.
Yes,
this
the Hudson Room.
The Hudson Room M restaurant. The other voice just heard is Mike Reed. You're the executive chef?
Yep,
the executive chef. Of the M restaurant.
Correct.
Empire now. Is that?
Not yet.
So what's I guess a good place to start is what is the sort of the concept behind
So when we started M near Martin Lane in 2014, we very much wanted to create an international restaurant which showcased the best beef and wine in the world. So we sat down and drank a lot of wine and decided what the six countries should be. So we basically then built the whole concepts and the menus off that philosophy. So we represent South Africa, Argentina, Australia, the US, France and Japan. Were the founding countries that we did, and so the menu reflects that. So we have steak from all of those countries. We have, and then the rest of the cuisine shows the best of those countries, the flavors and styles.
And what was your background, Mike? I mean, you were them from the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I started originally as a consultant. I was living in Australia at the time, and I was in the middle of opening a restaurant over there called Jardin Town. I was working with a chef called Shannon Bennett. So I was over there with Vudemon for a couple of years and then came back in to do M full time. Before that, I was the exec chef at Gaucho for 6 years.
Okay.
Well, 3 years as exec and 3 years as head chef. Before that, I was in Michelin, so I was in the Gavroche for Hospital Road.
Okay.
I did that scene in my younger days when I was a bit stronger and fitter.
And so,
a little bit more patience.
Gaucho, Argentine Steakhouse.
Yeah.
So you got an idea of meat there, I guess.
Absolutely.
And so coming in here.
Yeah, I mean, Argentina was probably where my beef obsession really began. The Argentines are obviously beef obsessed, but their passion for beef and for eating red meat is just incredible. You know, and I spent a lot of time in Argentina and in Buenos Aires and Mendoza especially. So it was phenomenal, a great experience. You know, working with Gaucho was an education in beef for sure. Mm-hmm. And then that carried through into my time in Australia as well. Okay. Aussies have some incredible beef at their disposal, you know, especially Wagyu. And I met some really, really, really amazing farmers over there in my time with Shannon. So I've been very lucky and managed to bring that back to the UK. And, you know, and M has exclusivity for what I believe to be the best beef in the world in Blackmore.
And the best beef in the world is?
Blackmore Wagyu.
From
Australia.
From Australia,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's, I mean, one of the things, I mean, the concept of this particular podcast is meat. I guess one of the things, knowing that you're kind of big advocates of Wagyu and Kobe and the various, I just wondered if you could help us and the listener understand
the myth versus
the fact. the beer massages and why Wagyu, why Kobe, and what the differences, etc.
Essentially, the key aspect of Wagyu, of what makes Wagyu so special, more than anything, more than the massages and the beer intake, which does actually happen, is the genetics. You know, and the genetics of the breed and of the cattle is what's sought after. So obviously the majority of the Wagyu that's on the market is usually crossed, which means it's crossed with an Angus.
And so Wagyu is the species?
Wagyu is the species, the breed. So, you know, if they cross it with a non-Wagyu, then it becomes a Wagyu cross. So then you get a diluted version, essentially.
But can they call that Wagyu?
They can only call it Wagyu cross, but people do call it Wagyu. Like anything, you know, people will find a way to cheat the systems.
Yeah.
So that then becomes, there are some very good Wagyu crosses on the market, but full blood, 100% Wagyu is obviously always better. You know, and I always say to people, it's very similar to drinking, you know, a fine wine. When you have a good wine next to a cheap wine, the good wine always tastes that much better because you can notice the tannins more of the cheaper wine. It grips your palate. It's the same with Wagyu. Like eating a cheap Wagyu or a cross, you know, it leaves your palate almost coated in that fat, in that layer. Whereas when you eat 100% full blood, it just melts away. It's rich, it's creamy, but it punches you and then just goes. You know, it doesn't linger. Doesn't leave you with that almost greasy sort of texture. And that's all about the genetics, and that's all about good breeding, you know. And then for Wagyu to be amazing, it's the farmers that do the hardest part. It's the farmers that, you know, in terms of the raising of the cattle, not rushing it. It's I was speaking to the Blackmores. I know them quite well now, and you know, they were looking for investment in their farm to try and expand, because, you know, obviously now they're a world-renowned brand and they don't have enough cattle to be able to meet demands of their existing customers, let alone grow it any further. And I was like, well, surely with your name, it must be really easy to be able to get, you know, to get investment. It's like, who wants to invest in Wagyu? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, it takes 8 years to raise cattle. Yes. You know, before they see return on their investment, it's like 8-9 years, Mike. It's like, fair point.
Yeah.
You know, it's incredible. And if that cattle, you know, if they conduct or contract an illness or has any issues with it whatsoever, then it's done. They've lost an 8-year investment straight away. Like, it's an incredible business when you look at it in terms of the risk. So they don't really do more than what they do now, you know. And they slaughter 69 heads per month, which is tiny in comparison to the typical Argentinian abattoir, for example. There's about 800 heads per day. You know, and Blackmore do 69 per month. So they're a tiny producer in comparison to the masses. And I mean, the American numbers are even far greater than that. You know, it's the amount of beef we consume is incredible.
Sure.
So when it gets to Wagyu, it becomes less and less. And that's what makes it such a niche product.
Okay. And that's something Neil and I were talking about earlier. We picked up on is a lot of people are saying, less quantity, more quality. You know, maybe you shouldn't eat beef all the time, but when you do, make sure, you know, it's got great provenance.
Absolutely. Like, yeah. Stop cooking steak at home, come to Amp.
But I agree 100%. You know, there's a lot on the market at the moment about, you know, fake meat and this, you know, things being developed so we can consume things which taste like meat but isn't meat, and the plant-based cooking and all that malarkey. Like, there's so much which is flooding the market. Just eat in moderation. Just eat it in moderation. Like, if I ate red meat every day, my doctor would probably kill me within a month. Mm-hmm. You know, you've just got to, it's 2 or 3 times a week and everything's fine. You know, and eating better quality, then, you know the cow's being raised in the right way, you know the farms are done right, you know the ecosystem isn't going to be affected, you know. It's the mass produce, it's the lower grades of the American beef, which are just done in the absolute tons each day. Yeah. That's what's affecting the market. That's what's affecting the lower end. So if you eat better quality but less, is definitely the way forward.
No, I spoke to the guy behind Ginger Pig years ago.
Yeah.
He was saying, if he's got 1,500 head of cattle on a hillside in Yorkshire or wherever he was based at the time, so if one gets ill, you take that away and you treat it.
Yeah.
If it's one of these mass production facilities where they're squeezed together, they have no exercise, and so you have to give 1,500 head of cattle antibiotics and all the drugs. And he said, how can what we do not be better than
100%? Yeah. Like, we buy American beef, but we only buy prime. And out of all of the American beef that's produced in the US, I think 4% of it is prime. You know, it's a shocking number.
Yeah.
If you think that, like, the size of their country and the resources they have at their disposal, it's incredible. You know, and it's just because they're trying to do volume. You know, everything they do is they're desperately trying to do volume. And Tyson, which is one of their biggest producers and exporters and distributors for America, like, they contacted me, the European director contacted me personally last year, trying to get me to buy through them. And I was like, why? And they're like, you know, why am I even on your radar? Like, surely I'm a small chain. It's like, yeah, but, you know, I make a lot of noise, apparently. So it would be a good one to have on their books. But at the same time, it's you know, it's like, you're everything that I hate about American beef. You know, you're exactly what I'm trying to take us away from. Oh, but we do the best prime. It's like, yeah, but prime is how much of your business? And he's like, what do you mean? Like, what's the percentage? How much of the prime is it in part of your business? He's like, it's like 0.5. You know, that it's just, they just flood the market with the cheap beef, with the stuff for burgers and the things that hit the supermarkets, you know, and it's terrible, you know, and that's why everyone we use for AM is a niche producer, with the exception of the USDA prime. Obviously it's not niche, but it is an incredible quality for American beef. But the French is niche, the Australian, the Japanese is Kobe. You know, every single one of them is a smaller farm and artisan, and that for me is the way beef should be.
It feels like there's a sort of celebration of the, you know, the more unusual cuts and using that importance of nose to tail, and actually 100%. Kind of respect for the animal as well.
Yeah, we try as much as we can to do the 2-to-1 philosophy with all of our suppliers for beef, and especially Wagyu, where we buy 2 secondary cuts to 1 prime cut.
Okay.
So that they, you know, because everyone wants the sirloin, everyone wants the ribeye and the fillet and yada yada, and then they can't shift the lower cuts. You know, the Wagyu I use for both Blackmore and Highland, I take knuckle, you know, which is, people don't even know you can cook with knuckle. Like, it's an amazing piece of the animal. And I use it for my tartars, you know, and it's the same grading as the sirloin at 9++, incredible flavour, and it is a third of the price, you know, and that for me is the art of good beef, where you can use every single part of the animal, and just find a way of doing it well, which fits the menus.
Okay. And you find your customers are, they're interested in that? I mean, I guess they're coming in here and they're wanting the sirloin, the filet mignon.
Definitely. I mean, it's not every cut is for every person. Like, my taste profile is very different to yours, for example. But it's we've got a really good, I describe our beef offering as similar to a wine list. We've got something for everybody.
Okay.
We've got leaner cuts, we've got fattier cuts, we've got things which are more chew, things which are less chew, things which are more full-bodied, things which are less body, you know, and there's an art to putting together a beef list the same as there's an art to putting together a wine list. You know, it's about covering off as many different flavor profiles and texture profiles as you can, and I think we do that fairly well here.
You mentioned 9++. I mean, can you run us through sort of the grading
system? The grading system is actually pretty poor in the UK because there isn't one. Okay, so in terms of scoring your beef in the UK, it doesn't exist. So which is why we have full blood and non-full blood when it comes to Wagyu, if it's British reared. In Australia, it goes from 0 up to 9++. I won't bang the table again. and then in Japan, it goes up to 12. So it's slightly different scoring depending on the country that you're in. In terms of American grading, it's select, choice, prime. So in Australia, 9++ is the highest you can get, essentially.
Okay.
Which is what we use with the Blackmore. And then in the Kobe we have on our menu here is 10+. But the highest you can get is 12 technically in Japan. But you don't.
So it all stays in Japan.
It all stays in Japan. You can't get anything higher than 10+ out of the country. And when you're in Japan, if you can find 12, call me. Because I think I've seen 11 once,
okay.
And I try. I go on these trips literally looking for the best. I found 11 once.
Okay.
Like, it's in such short supply.
So Wagyu and Kobe are both originally from Japan. Kobe is only in Japan,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you distinguish between the two and how...
It's like champagne and sparkling wine.
Okay.
Kobe has to be from Kobe.
Okay.
It's got to be born and then slaughtered in Kobe. Whereas Wagyu can be from anywhere in the world.
Okay.
So that's the only difference. Kobe has to be born and raised and then slaughtered in Kobe. So there was a thing a few years ago where Kobe, because of the amount they need to produce to cater for the world's needs now, they're being born there, shipped elsewhere, and then brought back to Japan for the slaughter. And then technically it's still Kobe. But they've now stopped doing that because there was such a raw ruckus. Because, you know, to be part of, to be able to serve Kobe officially on your menu, we're part of the Kobe Association.
Okay.
We have to pay a license, and it's not cheap. Like, it's thousands of pounds per year to be able to officially sell Kobe. So there's certain things which they then have to guarantee about the product and about the carcass which you're going to receive, and we can track every single animal that we have in the restaurant.
And I guess just the terroir, is that a large part of it? It's just perfect conditions for a cow to be happy.
Exactly.
Okay.
Which is why their beef started so good. Obviously, the genetics was incredible, but their terrain was exactly what they needed.
Once they got the bars, the massage.
Yeah,
you're
talking about
beer, it's all there. If you're a cow, you have a great time.
If you are a cow, if you're a Kobe, you're living the life. Some of the things are myth, but the fact that they have beer as part of their diet is true.
Okay.
You know, in the summer months, essentially, is when they get beer added to their diet to stimulate their hunger. Because the same as humans. In the summer, maybe not all of us, but in the summer, our appetites go down. You know, because it's hotter outside.
I've heard of people like that.
That's why I said, maybe not all of us. But, you know, essentially you eat less when the weather's hotter.
Yeah.
You're less active as well, you know, when the sun's out. So you move a little bit less, you eat a little bit less, and, you know, you're all a little bit more, you know, tired, and for the animals. So they give them beer, basically, to get them a little tipsy, to stimulate their hunger, and then they want, you know, so that, yeah, so it keeps them eating through the summer. And in terms of the massages, again, it's true, you know, if for whatever reason they feel the animal's looking a little bit more stressed or a little bit more, you know, uneasy at that time, they'll give them a bit of a rub down just to try and relax them, because they truly believe that, you know, the more hormones they're releasing due to their stress when they're alive makes just as much of a difference to the flavor and the texture of the beef. You know, we all now know that, you know, how we slaughter an animal is hugely important, but it's not just at slaughter when it comes to Kobe and Wagyu. They believe it's the way they live their entire lives. So if they're under, if they're in a happier place the entire time, then they'll, you know, they'll taste better at the end. And the Argentinians actually believe exactly the same. Mm-hmm. You know, they always believe and shout about their happy cows, which is why they, and it probably is true, because, you know, they've got obviously amazing terrains in La Pampas, where they've got so much open terrain to walk all over. So it is reflective in their belief. So it's a very, very good good solution the Japanese found many years ago.
Okay. I mean, just as a final point, so this idea, again, touched on the sort of the better eat, well, quality, not quantity. It feels like there has been a distinct kind of rise of sort of vegetarian menus and veganism and meat-free Mondays and stuff. How has that affected you, and where do you see M kind of going menu-wise in the future?
So, to be honest with you, we've seen no impact whatsoever. No. Because for the exact reason of people probably are eating it less, but they're probably then not eating it at home. Yeah. So it's their treat. So when they come out, they're eating it in places like ourselves, where they know they can get an amazing quality at a really good price, rather than going to the supermarket and buying something which they buy the best they possibly can in the supermarket,
right,
and then still not being that blown away by it at home. You know, so luckily, in touch wood, it continues where, you know, we don't see that trend. And to be honest with you, yes, there is definitely more noise, I call it white noise, now than there ever has been about, you know, plant-based eating and you know, veganism and so on. And I'm all for it. It's amazing. Great. Yep. Done. Every year, it's just in different forms. Every year we have the same thing. Superfoods was 2 years ago, then it was juice-based diets, and now it's meat-free this, and every single year, like, there's something that comes up, which, eat less meat.
Yep. Yes. Insect protein.
Eat less meat. Yes, we should eat less meat. As a country, as a world, we should eat less meat. We should eat everything. We should eat less fish. We should eat everything in moderation.
That's sure.
Just moderation. You know, okay, if you're having it in your diet, make sure when you do, you eat it well, you know, and you avoid the stuff the supermarkets flood on our shelves as well, which is really bad beef 9 times out of 10. Okay.
So for those special occasions when they do, they could come. Absolutely. To what, there are 3 M restaurants now?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's Fred
Needle Street in Bank,
uh-huh,
Victoria Street as well, just in the new Zigzag building. And then Twickenham, where we opened our, like, our baby M bar and grill, which is a British concept. Okay. So that's where we're showcasing the best of British beef.
Okay. And any future plans? Anything on the horizon you want to share?
We're looking at opening our 4th restaurant later this year.
In London?
Probably in London. We're looking at around the sort of the commuter belt. So maybe a little bit further out, but it depends on the site. Like, we've been quite active in looking for sites recently, so hopefully something will come up soon, but we're looking at the right place.
Okay. And if people want to hear or find out more about you and more about the restaurants, you want to share maybe your social media or anything?
So you can always check out what we're doing on our website, www.mwrestaurants.co.uk, and also you can follow us on social. We're pretty active. So mine is mikereedchef.com.
That's R-E-I-D.
R-E-I-D.
Okay. Great.
Fantastic. Mike, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Thank you.
3.
Mike Reed there. Not the EastEnders actor, but the exec chef at M. While we continue polishing off the smoked tartar, which was impeccable.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
So, yeah.
Oh my god.
So I mean, the again, the philosophy of Wagyu, that small amounts of really, really great stuff, and a little bit of respect for the animal and respect for the process, which I think, I mean, leading on to the next interview, which is something you did, Chris.
Yes.
With your friend Clifford.
Yes, Clifford Jones of Vaca y Marela. Clifford has this brilliant idea of bringing high quality Galician beef to the UK, and also just keeping some of it actually in northern Spain and Galicia, because not a lot of people actually
get to have it there, because it's all just goes straight to Madrid, straight to London, straight to Barcelona.
That's a nice touch.
And then also bringing high quality Dexter beef from the UK to Spain. And it's a lot like our interview with Mike. He talks a lot about, you know, just don't eat meat all the time, but when you do, make sure it's the best quality, and it should be a treat. And it was a treat talking to him, so let's listen to that interview now. Hey, this is Chris Osborne, and I am here with a very good, very old friend, Clifford Jones, in his office in London, and we are talking about Vaca y Morella, a concept he has started and is working on, and it is a very meaty one indeed. So, hello, Clifford.
Hi.
Yes, so we just got the recorder on, but we're going to just continue talking as we were. And we were talking about the concept, how you came to it, so...
Okay. It's a strange thing. About 25 years ago, I started to visit Galicia in Spain. And I discovered that Galicia is the home of some of the finest beef on the planet. Mm-hmm. It's also some of the most expensive, second to Kobe or Wagyu beef.
Okay.
So... I wondered, how could I go and try this? Where could I buy it from? And yet no restaurant sold it. No butchers would sell it.
In Galicia.
In Galicia. And I went and asked around, and they said, no. It all goes to Madrid or to overseas. I thought, well, this is crazy. Are there people not wealthy enough around here to afford it themselves? And they said, no, it's just a closed shop. It's a way that the cows are so limited, the numbers that they can produce, that they are bought before they even culled, and they are shipped off as quickly as possible to get the maximum price.
Okay.
So, with this in mind, it planted a seed, and I've been thinking about this for many years, and I just went and watched the various parts of agriculture in Galicia starting to disappear. And I noticed that the European Union had made it almost impossible for micro-agriculture to produce products and to sell them because of the restrictions and because of the testing that was necessary for the sanitary requirements of the EU. And of course, someone who only produces 3 cheeses a week cannot possibly afford to go and have their product tested, because if the testing would be their profit for an entire year.
Right, okay.
And so slowly, we've seen disappearance from the local markets of butter, cream, you know, and many other products, and including these meats as well. And yet, they still seem to be finding their way to large markets or rich markets across Europe. So with this in mind, I've taken on some thoughts as to how I could possibly help this situation, you know, and to create a business that could produce something which was not just good for the business, but also good for the local producers as well.
Okay.
So by selling their products for them on behalf of them, but creating a cooperative, as it were, so that we can test their products, get across the board, and then sell them under our brand, seem to be the right way of doing this.
Okay. So, just to establish a few things about why this is so important and special, and for people who might not know, Galicia is northwest Spain. If you're looking at a map, it's that bit that hangs over Portugal.
That's correct.
And maybe different than a lot of people's concepts of Spain. It's very green.
It's verdant.
Yeah, okay. Yes. And obviously, I've been with you actually a couple times, and it is lovely. So what makes that such a great place for beef? Why is beef from there so good?
I think it's the breed. Okay. It's first of all, it's exceptional. It's a Rubia Gallega.
Okay.
And the second one is a Capriccio di Oro.
Okay.
And these two particular breeds are incredible. They are dairy cows, and they get milked until 5 years old, and then they're retired. And it's at that point of retirement that suddenly they become something completely different. They change from being a dairy cow into being a meat cow. Mm-hmm. And the quality of the meat at the age of 12 or 13 years is exceptional, which, of course, nobody else is ever willing to go and keep a cow for that long.
Right.
And obviously the cost of doing so is ridiculous. For a smallholder to go and keep maybe two cows maximum.
Right.
And to keep them for that many years, fed on grass and then obviously silage or hay in the winter, is insane. And what they get back, obviously, is it has to go and reflect how long they've been kept, which is why they're so expensive mm-hmm. and so special.
Okay. And there's not a lot of it.
There isn't.
And okay. maybe Madrid, people in Madrid have been clued onto this for a long time, and now more recently, London restaurants and chefs, blah, 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 and it's all just going out of
Indeed.
Galicia.
Again, so, of course, it's the same old problem, whereby once the market starts demanding this thing and this product, it goes and takes it away from the very place it's from.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Okay. And what we've tried to do is to think of other ways as to try to, you know, to bridge that gap, as it were.
And who's we?
Okay, so my partner, Silvia Garcia.
Okay.
Okay.
Who's from
Galicia. Okay, who's a Galician. Okay. Has a an interest in this. She comes from a marketing background, but also from a farming background equally.
Okay. Oh, very cool.
So.
I know her. She is lovely. And what is your connection to this? Because... Clearly, you're as British as they come, and I mean that is the highest compliment. What is your connection to
My wife is Galician,
okay,
and I started to go there, okay, as I say, 25 years ago, and my love of food just went and made me curious as to what is it? What is it about this place that seems almost forgotten? It's a part of Spain that no one really visits unless you're a devout Catholic wanting to go to Santiago. But apart from that, it doesn't get much tourism. And yet it goes and has some of the finest foods in the whole of Spain.
Yeah. I get a lot of like the Percebes that go to the Basque Country and to Madrid, they come from Galicia.
Indeed. It's the same with the seafood. It's the same with almost everything.
Yeah.
I get that they produce all goes to other places to be sold for far greater values than they can realize in their own place.
Okay. And so you touched on a point, micro-agriculture. So that's sort of like a family farm, that sort of thing. And that's being squeezed out, you think?
Well, the farms still exist. Again, they're about half the size of a football pitch. Again, and that's before someone passes away. And then it tends to get split into two or even three. And then they just become smaller and smaller and smaller with time. And to produce something there economically, it's just not viable to do so.
Yeah.
And that is the issue. Traditionally, it would be three pigs, okay, two sheep, okay, two cows, and maybe six chickens.
Okay.
And that was your lot, as it were. And these parcelas, or parcels of land, were given out by the church in the about 200, 300 years ago.
Okay. And your idea is to be a collective for them, so you manage...
We manage what they can produce. We also try to encourage them to produce what we can sell
okay.
on their behalf.
Which would be high-quality, artisanal, traditional products.
Indeed.
Okay. Yeah. To Galicians, to people in Santiago...
And further afield as well.
If
we can. But mainly it's to the Galicians who are almost forgetting about what is on their own doorstep.
Right. Yeah. Do you think that's changing at all?
I think it is. Okay. Yeah.
And what indications?
We are noticing things like food trucks, street food, farmers markets are now starting to open up. Organic produce is also starting to become more and more common as well.
Okay.
All of these little clues which we saw in Britain in the last 20 years have now started to go and occur there.
Okay.
That's very common.
Yeah.
From music and fashion, it takes a few years to get to Galicia.
Sure.
Well, it's the same with food as well.
All right. Okay. Yeah. But there's, from my experience in Santiago... This year, there's a fantastic, small, but fantastic dining scene. I mean, you've got these great little bars and taverns doing the rustic, traditional stuff. And then you have, like, Casa Marcelo and these restaurants doing amazing things. one of the only Michelin star restaurants, the only Michelin star restaurant in Santiago de Compostela.
Indeed. Certainly, what has happened since the crisis is that Galicia is a land of restaurants. In fact, there's so many restaurants, you have so much choice, you don't know which one to go to. And that's one of the issues, because they all used to go and have specialities, I get of the house, and they all would do one thing, which was fantastic. What has happened, though, since the crisis, is that they've had to reduce their overheads, reduce the quality of what they're purchasing, and certainly stop purchasing from the local suppliers as well. So they can get cheaper tomatoes, which are grown in the south of Spain. They can get cheaper peppers from, you know, elsewhere. And their meat, I get, tends to go and come from, you know, from Central Europe even, because the price is so much lower. And what that's done is reduce the quality. And the problem with that is if you have too many restaurants selling substandard food, it has really destroyed that kind of culinary, you know, wonder, which is what Galicia was all about 20 years ago.
Okay, so it's changed that quickly, relatively, again. Uh-huh. Okay, and so you would be supplying restaurants with these artisanal products and great beef.
What has happened from this is a backlash.
Yes, okay.
So obviously you have a reaction to this, and people are starting to wake up to the fact of, hang on, where is my food from? Yeah. Hang on a second, this tastes like my grandmother used to make it. And, oh my God, this product, which I haven't seen for the last 20 years, is suddenly available again. So people are becoming more educated about their food, where it's from, and it is, as you say, where you've seen the same thing in almost every European country.
Sure.
Okay. Evolving over the last, as I say, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what does Vaca y Morella mean?
Okay, so Vaca is...
And how did you come upon this name? Yeah.
Okay, so Vaca is a cow, and Morella is a local term for a cow.
So Vaca is the Spanish...
It's more the Galician term for this particular type of cow called the Cachega Rubia.
Okay, so but in Galicia, the local lingo, it would be a Morella.
A Morella.
Okay.
Okay. So from this, we went and found an understanding with local people, whereby calling your brand Morella went and gave some connection to them, especially to their childhood.
Okay.
Because I believe that Morella used to be a cartoon character in the 1960s in Galicia. So, and they connect with this, and they like the name. What we're trying to achieve is to go and start selling these artisanal products, these handmade things, which we can now go and supply to restaurants to start with, and then we hope to supply to the people as well.
Very good. And how far along are you?
Oh, crikey. It's now been 3 years since we started the company, and it's slow. It's a slow process, okay? Spain and Galicia, of course, things don't happen overnight. They take time.
Okay. You seem patient about it.
I have to be patient. It's the only way to be.
All right. Okay.
Galicians also have a deep mistrust of other Galicians.
Okay. Right?
And they tend to go and prefer to see people from outside coming in and making the most of their resources, which is an unusual concept and something unique to Galicia.
Yeah, okay. And I know, just from personal experience, talking with you and being with you there, you love the place. You're an honorary Gallego, aren't you?
Absolutely. Okay, they love me, I love them.
Okay.
And certainly they love the fact that I really get what they're about and what they're trying to do and what they're trying to produce there, which has been forgotten.
Okay.
And that's...
So long-term strategy, you see yourself more there than here or anywhere else in the future?
I would say yes.
Okay.
My point is to help Galicians, and I want them to rediscover their past, and through that, the sale of our meat, to promote this, has been a goal that we're trying to achieve, and that's by selling those meats in London, but also the rest of Europe. Okay, but primarily to go and sell it to Galicians in Galicia.
Sure.
Okay.
How do you source these the meat? How do you find it? I mean, well, you just know a guy who knows a guy, drive around looking for the right.
I'm afraid in Galicia, it's you need to know a guy.
Okay,
how it works.
Okay.
And for years and years, this has been the issue, because the guy who knew all the guys was the person who was exporting these products.
Okay.
It is now starting to open up, because obviously the price, I guess, has meant that it's becoming more commercial. However, it can't be commercial because the limited production, and because of the bureaucracy that you can encounter when you're trying to do business in Galicia and in Spain.
Yeah. So from my experience here in London, as a food writer and also as just a guy walking down the street, I'm starting to see Galician beef at, you know, street food places, little lunch spots. How can you, a consumer in London, know that you're getting the right thing, the good thing?
Simply, you can't.
Okay.
Until
you taste it.
There is a thing in Galicia whereby any animal which goes and arrives in Galicia and lives there for 3 months becomes Galician.
Okay.
In fact, it's easier for a cow to get a passport in Galicia than it is for a person.
Okay.
So, you could take an elephant, literally go, and so long as it's gone and, you know, eaten and been fed in Galicia for 3 months, it becomes Galician.
So they're like, I can imagine, like these huge feed lots wherever in Europe. These cows, hormones, all this stuff, and then last 3 months they're in some horrible conditions in Galicia, and then
Galician
beef. Yeah.
And then it can be sold as Galician beef, and this is the issue. What you need to know is the origin of this. It's all about traceability. And so there are certain restaurants which can have that traceability and some that don't. And what you need to be asking for, is this Rubia Gallega, which is the breed, or Capriccio di Oro. And with that in mind, you can then kind of move on. And is this breed being reared in Galicia? Has it grown up in Galicia? Mm-hmm. And has it been, fed in Galicia as well?
And you can also tell by the way it looks, right? Like if you get a cut.
For sure.
It means sort of like a colored fat around it.
Well, the easiest way to determine most beef is the color of the fat. So if it has a yellow fat, you know that it's been reared indoors, or finished, as they say. So for the last 2 or 3 months of its life, it's been kept indoors and been fed grain. Okay. Mm. If it's been grass fed, it tends to have a whiter fat.
Okay.
And that is something that you really want to look for. The quality really is. If you can see a white fat, and the thing about these breeds is there's a lot of fat, and that's where the flavor comes from. That and the marbling through the meat.
Okay.
Also, it's about the cut of the meat as well. Would I eat rump? Or sirloin? Or would I go and eat a fillet? No, I wouldn't.
From these cows,
Yeah, just from these particular cows, because the quality cut that you're looking for is the chuleton.
Okay.
And the chuleton, or the chuleta, is the rib. And that is the eye of the rib, and you will always spot it because it should have this deep marbling, and it should go and have a fat content, which is almost equal, to the quantity of meat.
And it's similar but slightly different from like a prime rib.
Well, most prime rib in this country, in Britain, is served off the bone. The thing about Spanish beef is that chuletons are served on the bone, as it were. They are cutlets. That's what chuleton means.
Okay.
It's a cutlet.
Okay. Cool. So long-term plans, you're going to be...
Well,
you tell me.
We currently go and supply 3 restaurants, in the UK, with our meat from Spain. However, we're trying to find something which is more A, environmentally friendly, I get, and B, more commercial, because to keep a cow for 12 to 13 years is just not viable. So what we've attempted to do is to go and start to take our Dexter, which comes from our farm in Devon.
Okay, and so you have a farming background indeed. With your family here in Devon, yeah.
Indeed.
Okay.
And so from taking that Dexter, we are looking to start a breeding program. Okay. In Spain, and this is to produce a meat which is only at 30 months. Okay, and for me, the quality of that meat is very close to what they are producing in Galicia, but of course, it's a quarter of the time to produce it. There's also the whole issue of hanging and dry aging of meat, which in Spain isn't something which is so common. And that's due to the temperature. Okay, nobody used to hang meat. You know, it tends to be 14 days maximum, and then it's sold. And that has been an issue. But obviously, with refrigeration and dry storage units, or cámaras, as they call them in Spain, it is now possible for them to go and age their meat and to go and produce a far better taste and texture. Okay, to their product.
Okay.
But it's slow coming. It's caught on in the large cities, but in the countryside and in Galicia, it's still fairly unknown. This is really the key. A 30-month-old Dexter, which is hung for 52 days, okay, I can assure you, is so exceptional that it really rivals this product, which takes 12 years.
What makes Dexter so great? It's a small breed,
well,
right?
Well, because it's a small breed. So the first thing is it goes and has a small impact on the ground. So in the winter, when it rains, which it happens almost 200 days of the year, again, Galicia, it goes and doesn't mess up the field. It doesn't go and destroy the grass. It's able to stay outside far longer than the heavier breeds of cow. And the quality of the meat is exceptional. Okay. Small is beautiful.
Small is beautiful. Okay. Oh, right. Okay. And you want to talk a little bit about the restaurants here in the UK that you're already working with?
So at the moment, we've been supplying just recently Kitty Fishers in Mayfair.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. We have some of the Rubia Gallega and the Capriccio di Oro. Mm-hmm. And also we've been supplying Jerome. Okay, he's a friend. Okay, who has Le Wafu in Edinburgh. So,
and it is a fantastic, fantastic restaurant.
It certainly is, and it's very nice for me to go and supply a friend as well, because he understands what we're after.
And just so people know, it opened not even a year ago. It's already won Best New Restaurant in Scotland for 2017.
Indeed.
Yeah. Take that away
if you can.
Keep that in your mind. Yeah.
The only issue here is that he's a restaurateur. He's not a steakhouse.
Right? Sure. Yeah.
So for me to want to go and send him full Alto Lomo, which is basically a 15-kilo entire rib of beef, is something which is an extravagance for him.
Okay.
And something which he cannot do on a regular basis.
Sure.
And I think that is actually a great metaphor for how one should eat steak.
Okay. It should be a treat, right?
Indeed. It's not something that should go and be on the menu every night. It's not something that you should go and eat three times a week. It's something that once a month you should eat, and it should be the best.
Yes.
Nothing less.
Great provenance, great quality.
And traceability, so you know where it's from, what it's eaten, okay, and how it lived.
A lot of things are like that. Maybe salmon's a really good example.
I think so, yeah.
It used to be such a treat, and you paid for it, but you enjoyed it, and now everybody is expecting salmon all the time, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the high street supermarket, you get little salmon sushi, and it just tastes like crap, and it is crap.
Yeah.
And it's not appreciated anymore. It's diluted, yeah.
I see salmon as being overtaken by sea trout.
Okay.
Sea trout will become the new salmon.
All right.
Okay. Whereby this will then be farmed to death. Okay. And the flavor will go and be so diluted from what the real thing is
okay.
that it will be the same story as what happened to salmon.
Okay. Well, we were talking about beef, now we're talking about salmon, so maybe we've come to the end of our conversation. If people are interested in what we're talking about here, is there a way to get in touch with you or look up Vaca y Marella?
The simplest thing is just to look out for our name.
Okay, and that's V-A-C-A-Y-M-A-R-E-L-A. Marella. Okay. And you've got an online presence and indeed. Things like that. Okay, fantastic. Well, anything else, Clifford?
Well, what I'd like to go and say is that it's not just about beef, okay? It's about so much more than that. And beef is just something which was the first thing that we went and came across. But with time, we've discovered that there is so much more. After the Second World War in the UK, so many breeds of animal were reduced in such quantities to produce more efficient quantities of meat, okay? And rightly so, because this country was starving. But it was at the expense of difference and of choice. And to a certain extent, this is what's happened since the time of Franco, okay, in Spain. And they are suffering from the same way. So in this country, we have, what, I think it's 30 different types of pig, okay?
I'll take your report. Okay.
Yeah, and possibly even more types of chicken.
There's the Weinstein.
Okay, yeah.
The Franken.
It goes on and on.
No, that's my country, sorry.
Okay, that's it. Whereas in Spain, okay, if you go to Galicia, they have two types of pig, okay? Three types of cow, rather, and one type of chicken. And it's just like watching history repeating itself. And it's like it's waking up from this slumber and realizing that all of these things that used to be available, you know, 50 years ago, just have disappeared. But with some help and some assistance from the rest of Europe, it's going to be possible to put it back.
Okay.
To how it should be.
How it should be. All right. Well, thanks. Thank you very much, sir.
It's my
pleasure. I love talking with you, and I think this sounded great, so thanks.
Okay.
All right. Neil and I are back, and I hope you enjoyed listening to my piece with Clifford Jones of Vaca y Marella. We've just tucked into another course here at M. We're doing sort of a sample of Wagyu and Kobe beef. It's awesome. It took every ounce of everything for me to actually just stop eating and record this segment. But anyway, what we got next is we're sort of going on the other side of the spectrum in a way. We're going to talk with Nadia Stokes of Gourmet Goats. She and her partner, Nick Stokes, run this stall out of Borough Market. And I think Neil and I both are huge fans.
Absolutely.
And Neil, you want to set up the interview before we roll into
it? Yeah, sure. First time, as you're here in the interview, they started up at Ali Pali. Farmers market, so it's a great little Sunday market, which is kind of my local. And they were there one day at random, offering interesting kind of Mediterranean goat meat, which was only ever had in kind of West Indian sort of form before. Tried it, huge fan. They then kind of evolved. Got the regular stall at Borough Market, but what's great with them is to have seen them go from this kind of little test thing at a market for a couple of weeks into what's now not just a thriving business for them, but also a thriving business that utilises some meat that otherwise would just be incinerated and destroyed. So again, while we can get onto the sort of the ethics of the, and I'm sure vegans will. I'll give you Chris's email in a second, so you can.
Oh
say
yeah, it. Sure, yeah.
yeah. there is an element of dairy farming, which is again, some people see as slightly amoral. However, it is a sort of the nature of the beast, quite literally. And it's really interesting to see a company like this thriving and doing something that is utilising a product that is massively underappreciated in this country. And is effectively a byproduct of the dairy industry. So yeah, this is. We had a great chat with Nadia, and here we go.
So we're currently in the
in the bar at Rose Restaurants, looking above Borough Market. And we're here with Nadia Stokes of Gourmet Goat, one of the most award-winning stalls, most popular stalls, certainly with me, in Borough Market. So how did it get started?
Well, it started about 5 years ago. The idea started 5 years ago when I had just given birth to my daughter, and I decided I no longer wanted to work in the city as a corporate lawyer. And I wanted to follow my passion, which was food, and specifically my own heritage Cypriot village food, or peasant food, like I like to call it. But I thought it was quite important, if I was going to do it, that I would, you know, do something that was quite different and not add to the kind of the noise of that is, you know, the London food scene. So I had always wondered why I couldn't get hold of Kid Goat, which I had tried to get hold of on a number of occasions for, you know, various celebratory occasions, and I just simply could not get hold of it. And I then found out more about it, specifically how in the UK most of the male billies are culled as a result of lack of use, and with the proliferation of the growing need for goat's milk, the problem is only on the increase. So I thought, well, why don't I try this out in my local farmers market, which was Alexandra Palace Farmers Market in London. I created a traditional dish made from very, very traditional ingredients, but I used British kid goat meat, and I converted it into a traditional kind of peasant food, if you like. And I just wanted to see what people's response was going to be.
I remember it well.
And Neil was in fact one of my first customers, and he was very, very complimentary, and that was very encouraging. So we sold out on our first Sunday, and then subsequently and then you know, I decided that I had to continue with it, and I applied speculatively to Borough Market. And they invited me in for an interview, and then a presentation of my business plan, and then a taste test, and they offered me a spot.
Which they don't do.
They don't. No, no, and it was a real privilege. And Nick and I, my partner, we did say that, you know, if we were offered a spot at Borough Market, we would both quit our jobs. And we did. I remember actually Nick and I were at the taste test, but we had our daughter at the time, so, you know, there she was in her sling, being bounced around by Cannon and Cannon. So, yeah, it was very much a family affair.
Borough's leading charcuterie and babysitting service.
Yeah. No, they're just taking refuge. we don't leave them with children. That would have been fun, though. But, yeah, so, you know, that's how it started. And then the first 6 months, we started on Stony Street, away from the Green Market, where the hot food is. And we found it very, very challenging. It was very difficult. People's perception of goat meat wasn't great, and we hadn't exactly made it easy on ourselves. Perhaps if we had gone down the road of a goat burger with cheese, that would have been a little bit more amenable, but we didn't just do that. We went the full hog and just did everything differently, down
whole
to the
goat.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Like, even our Zanziki, we used chickweed instead of mint, because, you know, traditionally you would add, you know, mountain herbs. You wouldn't always do it with dill or with mint. You would use what you had available to you. So even down to that detail, we wanted to make the point, is that you should be living in harmony with your environment. But obviously the emphasis is mostly on goat, but in actual fact what we do, even our breads are made by a refugee group in a Hackney bakehouse. Because that's really important to us, is also showing support of our community as well. And also they make incredibly good sourdough wraps.
So, I guess, from your background as well, and your perspective on why you started this, you wanted to educate, or not necessarily want to educate, but if you're going to educate a group of people about how sort of the
always loath to use the word authenticity, but that's sort of the nature and the story behind it. I guess somewhere like Borough Market, you always had a better chance of teaching people, bringing or finding a willing audience.
Yeah. I mean, rather naively at the time, we did think that because we got into Borough Market, our success would be a dead cert. And we got to the 5-month mark, and we actually went to the market and we said, we can't continue anymore, we've got to go, and so we're going to have to tell our customers tomorrow, so, you know. And they said they're very sorry to hear that, and is there anything they could do to help us stay? And I said, well, potentially if you moved our location with all the other hot food traders, maybe, but there wasn't a spot, so that was it. So the next day, the next morning, Nick and I were literally about to send out an email to everyone, and we got a call from the MD of Borough Market to say, we're going to move you. We've found a spot. We're going to move somebody else, and we're going to move you. Please stay. And literally within like 24 hours, the whole thing changed.
Location. Yeah. So just sells everything improved.
Absolutely everything. Like we were doing, what were we typically doing on a Saturday, which was pretty dire. We were started doing on a Wednesday in terms of sales. So it just. Yeah, it's crazy to think that a few meters would have such a big impact on your business and your livelihood and your future. It's crazy, but it's true.
Well, if I may, I'd like to go back. So just when you started, you said you were having trouble just even sourcing kids.
Yeah, that's right.
So I guess basically most, the goat farmers, it's for dairy.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And so I guess it's a bit brutal to talk about, but what generally happens to all these little billy goats, all the male goats that are born?
Well, they get knocked on the head and incinerated.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. So you're, I guess in crass terms, you're accessing resource that nobody even was. It was just wastage, I guess.
Yeah.
And then on ethical concerns, you're giving these animal some kind of life, right?
Yeah. Absolutely, and a value, but also it's not. We try. It's a difficult one because in a way, yes, it is a waste. It's a byproduct of the dairy industry, but it's also very, very nutritious, very tasty meat as well. So, thank you. So it's, you know, in many countries, it's actually seen as, you know, a celebratory meat in the same way that you would have lamb on a Sunday. It's a special thing. It's not something that you would ever throw away.
Which is why you were missing it.
Yes, exactly, okay. Exactly. But just as an aside, just to talk about the farmers, you know, the farmers had no choice. They didn't have the luxury of bringing up the billies just to have them. Right. You know, a lot of the farmers are quite small, and to raise goats is actually quite expensive in this country because they need a special type of feed. Because it's not like in Cyprus where they can literally just wander around. They can be out in the fields all day. And, you know, it requires, and also there isn't the kind of necessarily the, you know, there isn't the market there to sustain that level of kind of, you know, meat rearing. So, from a business survival point of view, I have quite a lot of sympathy for the farmers. Because what else were they going to do?
And I guess
it's a brutal world, farming. Yeah. So.
No, absolutely. And I guess as an extension of that, from the use of Rose veal.
Yes.
Another, when veal had a terrible reputation, justifiably, through the sort of 70s, 80s, and probably into the 90s, certainly in the UK. But again, but you're using specifically rose.
Yes, yeah. We only use rose veal. And
so what is rose veal for someone who might not? So be familiar with the term?
Rose veal is a term given to veal that has been reared. So it's a certification that has been raised in an ethical way. The actual rose itself denotes the colour of the meat because it's so nutritious. And it's been raised in the right way. So what Neil was talking about in the 70s and 80s, the meat was very white, very pale, because the animals hadn't been allowed to grow in the way that they should have been. And so the meat lacked quite a lot of elements and gave it that really pale.
It's a lack of nutrition.
Yeah, so the RSPCA actually has endorsed this and actually supports the consumption of rose veal.
Okay.
So that's why we always make a point of saying rose veal, because we do actually have to address people's concerns and say, no, this is Roseville.
The fact that we've just had to establish what Roseville is,
yeah.
I think come up against that a few times with people you think would know.
Yeah.
Well, there's been quite a lot of publicity around it, but clearly not enough. There is still this need for an explanation of...
But do you know, I'm surprised how few problems we've had with bringing... Because Nick and I did talk about it and with the market, and they did say, you know, brace yourselves for comments that you might have, and even people were complaining. But I can count those incidents on one hand since we've been doing it. And I think part of it's because in the way in which we framed it, it's like a lot of what we do is all about the ethical side of it. And so it's almost like people feel reassured, so they don't seem to be worried about the fact that we're doing veal. So we've been quite... I mean, I say that, we'll probably have demonstrations tomorrow.
What's that sound
downstairs?
Yeah. What do you find people... Are you selling more goat, more veal, both?
It can be so neck and neck sometimes. And I'm surprised by that because, you know, we're called Gourmet Goat and it is a bit of a silly name. It was supposed to be a bit of tongue in cheek about, you know, what's the last word that you put next to the word goat meat. We were just having fun with it, but we never expected to add to it.
Attractive. Hang on, talk amongst yourselves, I'll come up with another one.
Thanks. When we come to rebranding. we didn't expect it. We expected the veal to be just a nice to have when people want something different, but it really is just, it's half and half.
Okay, wow.
That said, the halloumi is, it's doing very well as well.
How do you source your meat from? You got specific farms, or okay? You want to talk
about that? So we are the majority. All of it actually. Now we used to have two, but now we exclusively, I think, use just the one, which is in Yorkshire.
Okay.
And this farmer called Sarah Crane, and so she works for the dairy, which is, you know, a couple of miles down the road during the week, and then she also has her farm where she rears the billies. So the billies literally just go down the road to her farm and she rears them, and she's incredible, she's inspirational, you know, she's worked really hard to get them to the point where she feels very proud about the, you know, the ethics of it and the fact that they're free range, and she's great, she does a great job, and reassuringly for us that there's the animals don't necessarily have to go through, you know, any stress as a result of being moved around the country. They literally are, it's, you know, the dairy, the farm, the abattoir are also close by, and those are actually really quite important, you know, aspects. And then with the rose veal, we use this great farmer called Neil Weston, and he is a proper kind of, you know, farmer, very passionate about his rearing as well, and he's a little bit eccentric, please don't quote me on that. But he has the tastiest veal I've ever come across, and those are happy calves. They're really quite, yeah, chubby, you know. Chubby calves. Actually, they're not even calves, they're actually quite old. But, oh, yeah. You know that? I mean, they are. We refer to it as young beef when people need an explanation. And his farm is in the West Country. I can't remember exactly what the name of the place is. It escapes me.
And then you've got halloumi and...
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on the menu, or anything that you might be bringing?
We had the mutton,
the maritime mutton. On the website.
The mutton was really, really great, and we loved working with the mutton because it came from a farm called Village Farm in Cornwall, and there was a great story behind them, and they had the animals out, you know, all year round, and they didn't give them any antibiotics, and you know, these animals were reared the most natural way. They even grew all the right stuff that the animals needed to self-medicate. They were inspirational. But very sadly, the guy, one of the owners, he died in a in a horrible freak accident, and we didn't feel comfortable just lifting that recipe and using it with somebody else, because their meat was so exceptional and the recipe was created with them in mind. Like, it had marjoram because the meat tasted herby, so we wanted to accentuate that. And so all the different aspects of the recipe were because of them. So we stopped doing it.
So I guess people think about it with wine, definitely, but also, I guess, coffee. But there's terroir effects.
Oh, yeah.
The flavor of meat.
Oh, yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Well,
absolutely.
Yeah.
With their meat, it was just exceptional. They literally, the farm was on a cliffside in Cornwall. And it was arid land, and they built the farm themselves, and you could taste it in the meat. You know, there was like, it was almost like salt marshish, and
I wonder whether they say that the salt marsh lamb to maritime mutton.
It was amazing. It was incredible, and we were so tragic. They thought that the other partner thought that, you know, she could continue with it, but she found it impossible because he had died there. So. But it's something that we will revisit, back to your question. Mutton is, again, an underused meat. We will never do things like chicken, for example. We're more likely to do things like mutton or rabbit or venison, or, you know, things that which are considered to be lower impact, but at the same time consistent with my Cypriot heritage. But we kind of lack capacity, small space.
just to bring things to a moderate close, what's next?
At the moment Nick is working. I say Nick, I am, but not as much as he is, working with our local council to change all of their food offering to sustainable offering. So what that means is that, so the council owns the theatre cafes, the civic centre restaurant, their local cafe, like all the eateries that are owned by the council, we're gradually changing all of their suppliers to local suppliers, and then all of their food offering will be in line with what we're doing, but obviously without the Eastern Mediterranean. We're not going to get everyone in Enfield to eat koftas. However,
we could.
But yeah, so that's requiring quite a lot of work and a lot of Nick's time. And for me, I definitely don't want to open a restaurant. Did consider that, decided against it. I don't think I need to do that. I don't even think I have the skill set for it anyway. It would be great if we had a little slightly larger operation at Borough Market. But, you know, it's kind of limited in terms of what's available by virtue of the fact that it is the market and it doesn't have huge. But, you know, just continue to grow. You know, we're still growing. We're up, I think, 20% from last year. So, you know, it's still growing. There's still more to be done. And, yeah, organic growth.
So to help you grow, if people are looking for it, so you're in Borough Market.
Yes.
It can be a bit overwhelming if you're not familiar with where it is. So where about in the market are you?
So we are behind the iconic restaurant called Roast.
Okay,
and specifically
yes.
on Rochester Walk.
Rochester Walk. And if people want to look up, find more about you online,
yep.
Social media, all that, what are your...
So we are, our website is gourmetgoat.co.uk and then gourmet_goat on Twitter, and the same for Instagram.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Nadia Slopes of Gourmet Goat. You might have to excuse... Yes, for a little second, we're having a moment. Just had a little piece of Kobe.
It's a little piece, but it's a big moment in both their lives. Yeah, just so.
I need a cigarette. I don't even smoke.
Yeah.
That was astonishing.
I don't think I need anything, man. Wow.
That was incredible. I know it's one of those, again, very, very tiny amount. I think that was it 50 grams
yeah.
in total?
Yeah, yeah.
So 25 grams a piece. Again, this argument of small amounts, really great quality.
That I'm going to remember for a long, long time.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you were saying, Chris, about that integration of
fat and protein. It wasn't like, oh, here's the juicy fatty bits, here's the yummy meaty bit. It just all came into one for a moment. Yeah. Respect the meat.
Thank you, cows.
Yes.
Thank you, cows.
Cheers. Here's to,
I need to toast the cows.
Oh my God. And thank you, Japan. And thank you, M Restaurant. Oh my God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. That was quite astonishing.
I think maybe 15, 20 chews of just ecstasy. I don't know how to describe it. Liked it.
Yeah. I don't know what it costs. Just once try it. I would heartily recommend it.
Yeah.
So there we go. I think that brings us to the sort of slightly orgasmic end.
Yeah. The grand finale.
Too. So next time, we've got a couple of things.
Yes, yeah.
Planned.
We might be going deep with one subject, one of our favorite London chefs. Talking about all sorts of things with him. We'll see how that goes. But we are very excited. It will happen at some point. And we're thinking it's going to happen in time to be episode number 3.
Fingers crossed.
Of All Consumed. Until then, though, we are the All Consumed podcast. I'm Chris Osborne. This is Neil Davey. You can find Neil online at...
So the best way to find me, really, is probably social media, which is at DineHard. As I probably mentioned before, terrible film and food puns are absolute speciality.
Mm, it's important. Yeah, and I'm Tiki Chris, T-I-K-I Chris, .com for my site and at on Twitter. And this podcast is All Consumed Pod at All Consumed Pod on Twitter and allconsumedpod.com, I think. Actually, I'm in such a neat moment right now. I am all Kobe'd out. But if you type in our names, All Consumed, you'll find us. And thank you so much. And thank you, Neil. This has been
another
great
pleasure. Thank you for listening.
Adventure in food. Yeah, thank you so much.
Cheers. All right.